If you give people answers that don't require them looking at ads, it could completely destroy your business model. Here are five examples I saw that are Hooli level bad. Hooli level bad, to go back to our show from last week.
They're hilarious.
This podcast contains the arguably witty banter of two friends, Skippy and Doodles, that like to debate about investing. The content is intended to be entertaining and for informational purposes only, not investment advice. You should do your own research and consult a financial professional before using any of the information in this podcast, and especially before investing.
Have you ever been a bear on a tear?
If you're a bear, do you know how you break into those bear-proof trash cans?
You open them.
No, you just kick them over, dude. Just you hit the things hard enough on their side, they pop open.
Really?
Yeah.
You've done this.
I mean, yes, but I'm a human. So anyway, what's your point?
You always assume like I have a point.
That is such a good point. I always think you're going somewhere and you're usually just nonsense.
And that's my point. And that's
get
my
this.
Point.
This is what my kids did to me to wake me up this morning. They walked around the house, walked over to the main Alexa. We have multiple Alexas, and said, Alexa, play Skippy and Diggle's Talk Investing.
Did they really?
Yeah. So for those of you in your kitchen jamming to some Alexa, hello. I hope you enjoy that pizza you're making. I think we should hop into it.
Let's do it.
Google continues to amaze me in all the wrong ways. I think we're going to talk about that at the end of the show. But let's hop into some listener mail, huh?
Jingle jangle, baby.
All right, this is from Chris. Thank you, Chris. This consumed way more of my pre-show research than I wanted it to. This is a meaty piece. And the only way to say it, Dougals, is we are going to dive into the weeds a little bit because there's no way to talk about this without doing that, right?
Impossible.
So I'm going to give a high-level background, then I'm sure you're going to give some more details because you're better at backgrounds than me. And then I have so many thoughts, and I'm sure you do too. So Mary Childs, who wrote a fabulous book on Bill Gross, the Bond King, wrote this article with Justina Lee in Bloomberg, specifically about pharma and French. And for those who don't know who Kenneth French of Dartmouth is, or Eugene Pharma of the University of Chicago, like, if you don't know those names, it means you've never taken a trip to finance nerd land. Their research is widely quoted, and I have the number here, has been sourced at least 35,000 times. These are huge names in investing research. Is it fair to say that?
They are the center of the finance universe. If you go outside of CRISP, C-R-S-P, that is the Center for Research and Security Prices out of University of Chicago. They are the place where you get all your data, your data.
Yes. So their data set is available for free on the Dartmouth Talk website, if I remember correctly. And I did have the number correct. Since 1993, their papers, well, their most famous paper has been cited 35,000 times, including by people like University of Chicago PhD candidate Harry Markowitz, who is a huge name in and of itself. Clifford Asness studied with, he was at University of Chicago. I mean, like, these are giants. This is the Bible of investing research, effectively. And because their data set is free, it's used widely because anytime you want to do some backtesting, it's just the first and easiest place to go. And also, it has their names tied to it. And so it seems like a no-brainer place to start your backtesting.
I'm trying to think of the right analogy for how confident people can get when you just mention their names. I'm gonna pick on something that you absolutely hate. It's kind of like if somebody goes, wait, you in a stock market? Where you invested? You're not gonna make money. And you go, oh, I'm in NVIDIA. Okay, you good, right? It's that level of confidence that if somebody comes to you and goes, where'd you get your data? You go, oh, it's Thama in French. You're like, okay, you good.
Okay, you good. It's kind of cut to the chase. And to me, the article is really well done. There's also a podcast on it, so I consume both those things. We'll put this in the show notes. And thanks again, Chris, for sending this our way. Here, if we cut to the chase and zoom straight to the end, what happened between 2015 and 2022 is the data set has changed. This is historical data going back to 1926. And the really astute people go, why? Why did it change? And when you ask Pharma and French, again, cutting to the chase here, you feel free to add more detail. They kind of go, none of your business. like we're not really going to tell you that. And then when you pull the covers back even more and you start looking deep into the data is actually sourced these days by Dimensional Funds, who is a $700 billion asset manager who has a relationship with Pharma and French and who write Pharma and French checks and is a factor shop. And we'll have to define some of these things that would benefit from the Pharma and French data set improving, because that would mean all the back tests would look better and they could potentially get more gross assets under management and make more money.
These are conspiracy theories. These are conspiracy theories.
That's fair to say. Is that not where the article and the podcast goes?
No, it's exactly where it goes. This is the closest to going to a recent conversation that we had here on the pod about true crime.
Yes.
This is the closest you can get in the investing world, people. This is the closest you can get.
Our numbers are going to go up because someone's getting murdered at the end of this thing. Like, all right. So I have, Dougals, you're going to be shocked. I have strong feelings about this. But before I like monopolize the conversation, what did I miss? What are your thoughts on how this is laid out and the kind of finance level conspiracy theories that are being thrown around here?
Here's where I'll go. Here's where I'll go with it. So Fama and French, much like Skippy here, are value investing aficionados. So
hand up. Also strong defenders of the efficient market hypothesis.
No, those two things go together.
Only in Pharma French world do they go together. In the real world, those two things do not fit together. Go ahead.
Yeah. But, oh my goodness. Maybe I'll say this. Let me change it up a little bit. When people are looking to figure out valuation-based investing, Fama and French are core to that because they have the efficient market hypothesis. They are the people that are behind, like, how is the market valued? How do you think about whether or not efficient market hypothesis is taking in all information? All information reflects prices today, right? They are the people behind all this. University of Chicago, the basics of modern finance come back to them. And what's now happening is that they've said, you know what? There were a couple numbers that were off.
A couple numbers, 77% of the data set changed by more than 1%.
That's a couple.
And I'm going to speak out of both sides of my mouth. I'll cut to the chase with that. I don't think it's a big deal, but we're going to talk about why I don't think it's a big deal. There's one piece of background we just need to provide for your non-financial nerds, because this show has some listeners that don't even like investing. So when you hear about Pharma and French, you're going to hear about factors. And what those generally mean is these tilts of the historical data set that show outperformance. Value is the most famous one, which means cheap stocks. When you purchase, this is the buy low, sell high idea. Cheap stocks outperform the market. Small stocks, according to Pharma and French, outperform the market. Momentum stocks outperform the market, which is an ode to Dougals, right? Things that are going up continue to go up. Pharma and French are the reason and the core to, in a way, discovering those things. You're going to hear all my thoughts about why Benjamin Graham can run laps around these guys, but they're core to these fundamental factors. Those factors are core to so many quantitative research shops and investing strategy. The article says it's literally true. Trillions of dollars of assets are allocated based on these ideas that come out of their core data set.
And the data itself.
And the data itself, yes. So let me ask you, you dodged it earlier. Let me ask you for thoughts and a side. Let's do a side first. So like, is this a big deal or not? I think is the core question.
Is it a big deal when people use your data to backtest and you change the data? No.
Okay. Elaborate.
It's a free data set.
That's your whole take. That's
you, you get what you pay for.
I think that's true.
There's a reason. There's a reason that I've never used FAMA and French data on anything that I'm actually basing investment decisions on. I've only ever used it in places where I'm curious about something.
We were with a listener a couple weeks back. He said that he thinks we go overboard in talking about research recommendations and telling you that it's not investment advice, right? There's a reason for that. If you're putting your money on the line, like, you better be confident in your money. I remember when I first read about this, and I think it was like 2 years back. And my initial thought is, oh my goodness, this is terrible. So many of the core principles I have been disrupted. And then when I actually dug in, I went, none of the core principles I have been disrupted at all. And this is to Dougal's point, because I did my own research. I like made my own sandwich here and I'm comfortable with it. We're going to talk about that a lot going forward. That's where one of my rants.
You got bologna on that sandwich?
I got everything. It's custom to me. I got some pepperoni, some bologna. I got whatever I want. I got a hot dog wrapped in a bagel in there. Like, this thing is delicious and it's only for Skippy. Mary Child talks about, well, it seems like a small change, but if you would invest $10,000, the old data set would have said it's worth $250,000 over X period, and the new data set says it's worth $400,000, to try and explain that small changes are a big deal. But that's just because this is a really long time horizon at this point. Like, I'm not fired up about how little the data set relatively changed, but I actually like your take here. What you said is perfect. It's a free data set. If you didn't do your own work, you probably deserve to freak out about it. But it doesn't bother me in the least.
No.
Not one bit.
It's a free academic data set. I would change this up. If you told me that CRISP did this, again, the Center for Security or Center for Research and Security Prices, people pay like $100,000 a year or something like that to get access to that.
I do one caveat. I think because accounting rules change, new information arises. When they talk about why the data set changed, they say like they potentially could have discovered a double entry in 1950 by a New York Times author.
So CRISP changes their data a lot. Like, they go back and correct something. And 77%. So I feel like you were talking to my boy Kevin Richardson recently. You know Kevin Richardson?
No.
He's very well known. All of you probably, you may not know the name, but you know what he's connected to. Back in, I'd say about 25 years ago-ish, he came out with this line. He went, "Tell me why." Kevin Richardson was in the Backstreet Boys.
That joke was so long. So long. Okay, so the "tell me why" is the problem. I mean, the other thing we don't have to spend much time on is Farmer and French, in addressing why the data set changed, kind of had a snarky response and said, "It's free, we'll do what we want." Because it is free and they will do what they want.
It's free and academic.
And the last point, gosh, I have so many thoughts here. But the last point relating to them specifically and their tie to Dimensional, of course they get a paycheck from them. The fund company wants to use their names to sell their funds. And it's a former student. Like, they're bound to get rich. This is how the world works. Incentives drive the world. And I think it's very good to point out that Farmer and French have such a strong relationship with this one firm. And that firm actually manages preparing the data at this point. But don't act surprised, people. Like, this is how life works.
This is the part that is a bigger deal in my eyes. The fact that you have these academic researchers who typically don't get involved. The last time I can think that people that had this big of an impact on investing got involved in a fund was long-term capital management. They were much more involved than this.
And for those who don't know, that blew up in a ball of flames and was not the funniest thing about long-term capital management is it was not long-term.
No, nor was it capital management.
Great name, though. Great name. That's the name I'm going to use for my fund. All right. So if it's okay with you, if you humor me, I want to talk about why this is not a big deal at all to me, and why every time I look into it, I go, I don't really care. And that is because, I'm going to talk value investing for a second. You know that I fundamentally believe, and I'm oversimplifying a little bit here, but that value investing is essentially betting on mean reversion. And I believe mean reversion is embedded into the human psyche. And therefore, it's more of a behavioral investing style than almost anything else. And again, I'm oversimplifying, so bear with me. But I'd be terrified if the Farmer French data set was revised and said, in this case, it said value investing performed better than they had previously. But if it said value investing performed worse, and I had no other place in the world to turn for my back tests to be like, this is a good strategy. In my situation, I have like 10,000 other places to turn for back tests that have nothing to do with Farmer and French. You can go to Japan in 1980s, Japan in 1990s and 2000s, when the rest of the stock market performed horribly. Value investing performed great, independent tests there. You can go back to one of my favorite papers from Warren Buffett himself, written in 1984, called The Super Investors of Graham and Doddsville, where he says, hey, look, me and all these random people studied under Benjamin Graham, and oh my goodness, all 12 of us outperformed the stock market. Do you think there's something going on here? You can go to Seth Klarman. You can go to Howard Marks, who invests in bonds but uses a value investing approach. You can go overseas. I mean, are you sick of me talking about this? There are so many examples that have nothing to do with Farmer and French. Let's say the strategy that I like, again, with that hot dog wrapped in a bagel in the middle of my sandwich, because it's customized to me, because it's research I've done, performs. And so, like, I'm happy with it. The only thing I'd argue for the listeners, if you want to be this deep in the weeds, is find your own thing that you have like 100% confidence in, and then you're good. It doesn't matter what Yahoo's changed their data set. And I'm not calling Farmer and French Yahoo's, but I kind of am.
Yahoo's finance. The thing that I'm going to take this to a little aside here for a second, because you just brought up a completely different topic that we have not discussed here previously. That is going to have unprecedented impact as well, just like this. The definition of a sandwich. Did you see that in Indiana, the United States of America, they have declared that taco is a sandwich? Did you see that?
I did not see that. I have mixed feelings about that. I did. I was at a business conference this week, and like on one of the televisions in the background, they were debating taco sandwiches, and I was really unclear as to how that topic even came up.
Indiana has said that the courts of Indiana have declared that a taco is a sandwich.
And why does the classification matter?
It matters because there was a restaurant that needed zoning rights, and the place that they were doing business was only zoned to be able to serve sandwiches, and it's a taco shop. So they raised the question to the courts of whether or not a taco is a sandwich. And if a taco is a sandwich, anything is anything.
This is the only show where you get this hard-hitting Farmer and French breakdown and taco sandwich breakdown within seconds of each other. I mean, so sorry, I went on a rant, a self-serving talk my own book rant. Thank you for humoring me on that. Am I right? Do you feel the same way?
Yes.
About your investing philosophy, you know?
Yes, I think. The difference is that Maybe I can't say yes, because I think I'm going to say yes, and then I'm going to say something different.
Okay.
A difference between our two investing philosophies, if you come down to the nit-grit of it, is that you do have a lot more that's backing up your investment philosophy than I do.
Well, yours is pretty unique, and I want to say bleeding edge, but like I'm talking bleeding edge in terms of decades rather than in terms of I've hundreds of years, yeah. Or even if you only go back to Graham in the 1940s, like, yeah, there's just more. It's been it's an easier to implement philosophy. You almost need computers for the Dougal style. You don't need computers for the Skippy style. Anyway, I hear you on that front.
Yeah, but I do agree with your general take on yours, though. It makes sense. The idea that something is worth more, and you find it when the behavior of the market says it's worth less, like, just makes complete conceptual sense. Like it, you don't need FAMA and French data to get the philosophy down.
Yeah, and the other thing I'll mention there is there's been debates for, again, at least 60 years about the right way to call something a value stock and whether you free cash flow to price is the right metric, or price to earnings, or if you should take some account of the balance sheet. I mean, there's all these other ways. So that's been beaten like a dead horse outside of pharma and French to say, like, what's the right approach to this? And there are strong opinions there and backtests that do different things. But generally, that principle of the stock is super cheap or a dumpster fire, and it therefore outperforms the market going forward, holds true.
Do you think that their data is more accurate now?
All I would say, one, so the real answer is I have no idea. But I hope so. I mean, I don't, even if you believe the tilt of the article that implies that there might be some nefarious stuff going on for profit, they're giants in the industry. And I can't imagine them signing off on, let's do this wrong, or let's like deceive. Like, they have plenty of money, you know? They're not in the poorhouse or anything. So all I can say is I hope so.
It would be weird if Dimensional created data for the public to consume just to get very short term like cash flow. Like, it would be so strange for them.
Yeah, the hard part is, and this is not about Dimensional at all, but when you talk about companies or individuals, you never know exactly what's happening. You know, you never know which neighbor is actually facing bankruptcy and how desperate they could be. With Dimensional specifically, as it relates to this conspiracy theory, we'll call it, I'm at the point where if I invest in Dimensional funds, and I think I actually have a holding in one account where I don't have access to many funds, that's a value tilt with them. I think that's true, but I can double check. Their track record needs to speak on its own now. I don't care what the pharma and French data set implies about the strategy that Dimensional might be implementing. They've been around long enough that they need to be beating the market for me to get excited about it, because they do charge high fees. So like, I don't care all about that. And I would think your average investor would know even less about their tie to pharma and French. So I don't know how many dollars that moves to them. I really don't.
Question for you, if you don't mind divulging, how much do you pay for data annually?
For investing?
For investing.
Data?
For investing.
Like, yeah. For back tests?
Just whatever you use in investing.
It's probably about $1,000. And I wouldn't classify it as, it could be more. So I classify it as not necessarily data, but like aggregation of data and analyst recommendations and like all these things. You know, like it's,
yep.
It's not a raw data set necessarily, because I've done all the back testing I needed to do in the past to get comfortable with things. And I have no need for like a Bloomberg terminal because I know my strategy enough. So
but you pay for the data that feeds your model, right?
No, the data that feeds my model is readily available with it, like on certain brokerage platforms.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So in a way, I pay with having brokerage dollars at places that can do the screening material that I need. But and then I pay for like three other sources outside of that. Sorry, that's a convoluted answer.
Yeah. But regardless, it's not nothing. It's not like a boatload, but it's not nothing that you pay. And this goes back to when you asked me my opinion earlier, is that this is an academic free data set. You have two people here. I also pay, if you go all in, like you were describing, probably $600 a year for data. And it's because there are people that have told me that this data is gooch, and I've tested it and it looks gooch.
Gooch. Oh man. But let me try and wrap. Does this mean anything to your average investor? I think it means next to nothing.
Absolutely not. And it shouldn't, this should not matter. I think it's interesting. And Chris, by the way, what I'm not saying is why'd you send this? It doesn't matter. Because I actually think that the conversation is quite interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's quite interesting around it. But my immediate reaction was, oh, that's interesting. I wonder what the data says now. Like that was my reaction, because I'm not about to base investment decisions upon FAMA and French data purely. Not at all. But I've always viewed FAMA and French data as really interesting for directional takes. I think that it's hard to get data that goes back this far that's as broad as a lot of the data they have. Like there's such interesting information they have on their website. So I'm like, directionally, that's interesting. Yeah. Directionally, that's interesting. Now let me go do my own research.
So Mary Childs, again, one of the authors of this piece in a podcast talking about this piece, mentions how small the change is in basis points in terms of total performance. And then she aggregates it over 100 years and says, like, actually, I think it only goes to 2005 for her analysis, and says, but it's a big change in gross dollars. And the whole time, I mean, this is the world's biggest eyeball roll for me. It's like, I could care less. In 1926, when the data starts, do you think anyone in their right mind could have implemented the Pharma and French value investing strategy by walking down to their local broker and saying, like, give me these 17 stocks and short these 22 stocks? Like, it's
Jesse Livingston
gibberish. that ended poorly. it's complete gibber. There, you could not implement this investing style anywhere close to theirs, probably pre-1960, if not pre, like, 1985. So to take these back tests and be like, oh my goodness, the gross dollars matter. It's like the gross dollars were made up anyway. No one could actually do that in real life. It's this core high level principle of like, hey, cheap stocks appear to outperform if you're smart about how you handle that and have the intestinal fortitude. You like that, Diggles? To actually hold on to those cheap stocks because they're all dumpster fires.
Thank you, Chris. I think we should talk about AI. You lit me up with Google AI this week.
I did. I pride the show on, you know, doing better research than average and, you know, doing a sanity check on the data and stuff before we just flippantly talk about it. Here's the caveat with this. Twitter, just the algorithm found out that I laughed at Google AI stories this week, and it threw all this stuff my way. Now, I did not have access to this, so I could not independently validate these, but none of these tweets have community notes on them. So I think I'm pretty confident that these are actual true data sets. You'll see the reason for this caveat is because this stuff is so outrageous, it's hard to believe.
Sorry, you're gonna go into this, but I was just looking, and the comparisons that I'm seeing here are people are comparing Onion headlines, like The Onion. The Onion is a parody periodical in the United States, now owned by the former CEO of Twilio, which gives me even more confidence in Twilio as a stock that I hold. And people are comparing the results from Google AI to Onion headlines.
Let me go through a few examples. So, and the background here is at Google's event 2 weeks ago, they said, you know what? We're not going to fight innovation here. And we're going to slowly roll out AI summaries of the search at the top of our search page. And the reason that causes so much concern for Google is because Google is an ad-based business, where 90%+ of their revenue comes from Google search. And if you give people answers that don't require them looking at ads, it could completely destroy your business model. Here are five examples I saw that are, Hooli level bad. Hooli level bad, to go back to our show from last week.
They're hilarious.
Yeah. First one, someone Googled, which president graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Madison? And it says that there are 59 degrees from presidents from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is not even close to true. And it claims that Andrew Jackson graduated from there in 2005. Andrew Jackson's been dead.
Do you know he didn't?
He didn't go there at all. I mean, it says Andrew Johnson. I don't know, earned 14 degrees in starting in 1947 and wrapping up in 2012. No, it's complete gibberish.
And hold on. And sometimes that's just false information. And sometimes the information could be dangerous. Look, can I? I'm going to give you an example here.
We're going to get there. I think that's the next
I'm gonna give
example.
An example here. So cheese can slide off pizza for a number of reasons. This is cheese not sticking to pizza. Cheese can slide off pizza for a number of reasons, including too much sauce, too much cheese, or thickened sauce. Here are some things you can try. Mixing cheese into the sauce helps add moisture to the cheese and dry out the sauce. You can also add about 1/8 a cup of non-toxic glue to the sauce to get more thickness.
I mean, I would hope it's stickier if you're putting glue in. I mean, it actually gets worse. This screenshot, someone typed in, I'm feeling depressed. And it says, there are many things you could do to deal with your depression. One Reddit user suggests jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge. Again, I have not seen anyone debunk this. It seems horrible and unbelievable. But Dougal's, the great thing about, how do I put it? The dangerous thing about the internet was that anyone could write anything. But we kind of found safeguards for that. For example, like Wikipedia has moderators. So when someone goes in and types something that doesn't add value or is false, it usually gets corrected. And it usually gets corrected pretty quickly. Google just going to anyone that types anything on Reddit and saying this is like factual information seems to be a very poor decision.
This was the first week that what you described, what was it, 7 months ago, around Google versus ChatGPT came to fruition for me. Like normal Google, not Google AI.
Yeah, yeah.
This was the first week it came to fruition. I was trying to search for something. Doesn't matter what it was. I was trying to search for something on Google. It's like a normal search. And I went, I like literally cannot find the answer, which is rare.
Yeah.
And then I said, let me just go try ChatGPT. And immediate.
Nailed it, right?
Yeah. And I went, I haven't seen that before. And I'm wondering if the people that ordinarily would be continuing to improve Google's search algorithm are instead trying to figure out how to get you to eat glue in your pizza.
There's three more examples I just got to mention because we want to make you laugh today. Apparently, if you Google the states with the largest population, it's going to tell you Georgia, Illinois, Arizona and California in that order. I don't have access to the AI version. So, you know, it's so bad. If you Google how many sisters do I have right now, which is a weird thing to Google, I'll give you that. But the AI overview, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, you'll see why, says you can count the number of sisters you have by asking someone to write down the number of brothers you have, then multiplying that number by 2. Next, add 3 to the result. Multiply that number by 5, and then add the number of sisters you have. Finally, multiply that number by 10. Then it gives the example and says this person has 680 sisters. How stupid is this? How did anyone greenlight this? Did this make your search better this week, Dougal's? Like,
yes. Wow. Yes, because usually I don't go and search for entertainment.
Okay, and then the last one, this is what you're mentioning, and as best I can tell, this is what actually happened, but we're waiting on fact checkers. So someone asked, how many rocks should I eat each day? According to UC Berkeley geologists, you should eat at least one small rock per day. There's a screenshot of that. Right next to that is a screenshot of an article from The Onion that jokingly says, geologists say you should eat one rock a day. I feel like I've said we haven't fact-checked this 1,000 times. I'm going to say it one more time. It certainly appears like Google crawled all the web and was unable to diagnose if people on Reddit are joking, if The Onion is a satire newspaper, and then is recommending that advice that is clearly wrong as like gospel of the internet.
I kind of can't believe all these things.
I basically can't believe all these things.
Because Google's entire business is based off of the idea that they can figure out more credible versus less credible sources. That's their baseline business.
That's why they're a multi-trillion dollar company. That right there.
So like, I don't know how it got to this. There are just so many examples is the only reason that I kind of believe in. But
it, again, let's assume that none of this is true. All I would say in that case is their PR team is getting crushed and probably needs to be fired, because this should be immediate. There should not even be social media buzz out there. They should have blog posts and influencers and whatever else immediately saying, no, look, here's what it actually says.
Sorry, but last week you were joking when you were saying that Google has become Hooli. Mm-hmm. It was a joke. I was like, haha, because it's funny. That's what I do when things are funny, by the way. It was funny. But what's not funny about it is when this is happening to you, to your PR team thing, this is happening to you, and you have an EDM celebrity screaming Google into a microphone. Like, what happened to your organization?
I don't know. And I have mixed feelings here, because I don't really like trashing anyone or any company, and I'm not really trying to do that here. This is objectively hilarious. It is a sitcom that we both enjoy. Like, I don't know what else to do than laugh, but I'm not like rooting for anyone's failure here. And I would love for, again, hire 10,000 overseas consultants to go do community notes and corrections on all the social media. If there's stuff out there that's blatantly false, please do that, and do that tomorrow for the reputation of your company. Because people like you and I, we have less confidence in Google today than we had 2 years ago. And I think that's probably true for the most of the population.
Truth.
That's a big deal.
Truth.
Is there anything else in your fishbowl?
I don't think so.
Okay. I want to talk about one thing, and we'll just call it this is kind of a social media show, which we never do. There's a TikTok finance thing going on about how it's cheaper to live at an all-inclusive resort than it is to live in middle America. Were you able to consume this?
Yes. It's so good.
Again, another thing that makes me laugh. But the thing that's so interesting here is it's narrative storytelling in a way that the results are so cherry-picked that the conclusion is theoretically true, but it's kind of like, no. So the person here picks, by their words, a very average 3-bedroom home. And they use some term like middle America. Now, when I think middle America, I think like Kansas or, I don't know, Missouri. What's middle America to you?
Yeah, I think that's right. Anywhere between Ohio and Kansas, probably.
There we go. So I know for a fact you can buy homes in Kansas for $100K and probably a 3-bedroom home. Is it going to have the amenities you want? No. Is it like, but the home they happen to pick is in Boulder, Colorado, which is where my office is, and is one of the most expensive housing markets in the United States. Now, it's not San Francisco or New York, but it's getting up there. And then they, in building their financial statement, say, well, it's America, so you have to have a car. So they buy a brand new car, right? A brand new SUV. They insure all these things. They like build in $300 a month because they have to have fun. You know, you have to go out for drinks with your friends. You can't actually go to the park and like buy a 12 pack that's $18 or whatever. Like, it's just so tilted to, I have to have this way of lifestyle. Cut to the chase and whatever, they estimate costs after insurance and the car and eating out and some other fairly lavish expenditures to be like $700 to $800 a month. And then they show you this all-inclusive resort. I don't even remember where it is, but in a non-expensive part of the world where two adults can eat and drink and stay for like $6,500 a month. Fascinating thought experiment. I love these things. I love like saying the trade-offs of this financial decision are X and Y, because there are always trade-offs. Does anyone in their right mind think that you need that bare minimum? You need to buy an $800,000 house in one of the more expensive places in the world, that you need a brand new car, and that your quality of life stuck in an all-inclusive resort where people leave every week and you never have an opportunity to build relationships and friendships, and like there's nothing long-term about your existence. Does anyone think that would be a better life?
Here's what I think someone's going to do. They're going to go, hey, baby, you and me, I just did the calculations.
Yeah.
We can go and retire to an all-inclusive and just trade based on FAMA and French data.
Well, there is the famous example of one couple who retired and calculated that what they wanted to do is cheaper to just do one week after another on cruises. Again, that's going to end badly. And talk about the trade-offs there. But what I wanted to say as a PSA here is, like, there's deals for $1,500 a month with some hoops that you can get basically unlimited flights and unlimited lodging through most places in the U.S. There's ways. If you want the nomad lifestyle, you can do it for a lot cheaper than $6,000, as this thing implies. Like, or if you truly are on, I don't know, an average to below average income, and you're willing to, like, make some trade-offs, you can find homeownership in this country for a very affordable prices. You just have to go to it. You don't get to be picky about where it is.
And that is, this is the point that the implicit point I think you started off with is what America seems to have become today, which I hope shifts away, is a place that there is a specific lifestyle that you have to live and that everyone's also entitled to. And that needs to go away if we want to continue to grow as a society. Otherwise, because the person that made this, again, I think it is an interesting, I think it's funny and an interesting thought experiment. She's saying that it's $6,000 a month is middle America. And that's just, it's not the case. Like, that's not the case. I also am curious about this all-inclusive.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. A month might be fun. Like, I'm just saying, don't live there permanently. That's all I'm saying. I think I love that you're kind of bringing that back to that because ultimately none of this stuff is too simple. I can hear Munger in my head. It's like, figure out what you bring in the door and then right size what you can afford with that. It's not the other way around. It's not like I have to drive a 5-seat 2024 SUV and I have to live in X location. We all have made incredible trade-offs. And with the Boulder, Colorado example, I can also find you, I don't know, 10 other homes within 45 minutes of there that are going to be half the price. You know, like, there's plenty of options.
I feel like you need your own, like, search, like Skippy search, that people can come to and say, here's the thing I'm trying to do. Can you find me 50 other options that are cheaper?
Yeah,
that's a valuable service.
I actually think I'm writing a book along those lines, but I'll tell you that off pod. Anyway, Chris, thanks again for the listener mail. We dove deep in the weeds today on finance, deep in the finance weeds. So if this show is a little too nerdy for you, go back an episode or two. You'll probably have more fun. We love new subscribers. And we mentioned last week, we're seeing a lot of traffic on Spotify. So if you could give us a review there, that'd be greatly appreciated. More listener mail can hit skippydougals@gmail.com. And if you want to support the show, become a true fan of ours and help with the behind the scenes cost, we appreciate that. Premium subscriptions are available at skippydougals.supercast.com. Thanks, guys.
Donkey shine.